This is the Rob Call Bottom Up Show, sponsored by opednews.com. On Pacifica, Progressive Radio Network, iTunes, opednews.com/podcasts with an S, and Stitcher. Humanity is transitioning back from a predominantly top-down culture to a more bottom-up one. It's changing everything. I'm Rob Call, and I have conversations about top-down, bottom-up, about change and making change happen with some of the smartest, most interesting people in the world. Welcome to the show.
My guest for this show is Roy Adelson. He's a clinical psychologist and former executive director of the Solomon Asch Center for Study of Ethnopolitical Conflict at the University of Pennsylvania. He's a past president of Psychologists for Social Responsibility, which is where we first met. And he's also been honored with the Anthony J. Marsala Prize for the Psychology of Peace and Social Justice. He has a new book out, Political Mind Games. His website is royeidelson.com. That's royeidelson.com. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Rob. It's great to be with you.
It's a pleasure, and we've had some face-to-face connection over the years, and I've really appreciated the work that you've done, particularly regarding dealing with torture and American Psychological Association policy. You've really done some great work there.
Thank you. Continues to be an issue, and it was a big part of the past decade in terms of my own efforts.
And a great success, too. You guys really made it happen.
Definite progress. You know, now it's a question of holding on to it. Not everyone is happy with the changes.
Maybe we can get into that a little bit. But I want to start with your book. The book is Political Mind Games, How the 1% Manipulate Our Understanding of What's Happening, What's Right, and What's Possible. I'm reading off the book cover. You refer to the 1% to plutocrats and to the predatory class. Who do you mean? What are you talking about?
Well, I use those terms interchangeably in the book. And the people I'm referring to, the individuals and the groups, are those who are committed above all else to preserving and increasing their already enormous wealth and power at the expense of everyone else. So, you know, the idea of the 1% became popular when we go back to the Occupy movement. I don't mean specifically, statistically, exactly those who have the 1% greatest wealth or anything of that sort. There are a lot of wealthy people who are committed to a progressive agenda. I'm referring to those, you know, at the very top in terms of wealth and power, who are not and who are instead committed only to themselves.
Yeah, I think, you know, I call the show the bottom-up show because I think we're transitioning from a more predominantly top-down culture to a more bottom-up one. And I think of those are the people at the very, very top of the power curve, at the very top of the hierarchy, the people who are predators. And that's the way you characterize them. So the other part of this title and subtitle is mind games. What do you mean by mind games?
Mind games is the term I use to refer to the manipulative appeals that the 1%, or today's plutocrats, use to serve their own interests while appearing to be operating in a way that benefits the common good. So a lot of, you know, sometimes it's obvious that someone is lying or is out only for himself or herself. More often, I believe, we're not aware or not fully aware of how we're being manipulated, and how certain phenomena in the world, whether it be about war or other forms of injustice or mass incarceration or poverty wages, how those are being explained or justified through the use of kind of clever, deceitful propaganda that has the ring of truth. So mind games have the ring of truth, but in fact, they're empty. Nevertheless, they keep us off balance. They keep us from forming coalitions. They keep us from achieving the agenda that most Americans want.
Now, when I think of, when you talk about that, I think of Frank Luntz and George Lakoff, and they're thinking about framing, political framing, and languaging of words. How's that relate to mind games?
Well, George Lakoff's work is really important, and he looks at framing, as you described, and kind of at the neurolinguistic level, in fact. What I have done is I focus on five core concerns that I believe are central to how you and I and pretty much everyone else make sense of the world. And those concerns, because they play such a crucial role in our own understanding of what's going on, they're soft targets for manipulation by those who have their own self-interested agenda. So my model, my framework in the book is built around the manipulative appeals or mind games that target these five concerns.
So they're not really related to framing then?
Well, the appeals themselves definitely frame issues to the advantage of the 1%, but
That's what I thought. I mean, it seems from what I've read in your book, there's a lot of framing involved.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely about framing. What I'm noting is the importance of, you know, what are the targets of framing, or what framing is likely to be most effective? And it's my thesis that the most effective framing is that which targets five concerns.
And those five are vulnerability, injustice, distrust, superiority, and helplessness. And we're going to spend a lot of time talking about each of those.
Great. Yes. Should we start now?
Well, first, you talk about there's a vision that the plutocrats or the 1% have, and then you have a different vision. What is their vision, and what are they aiming to do by playing these mind games? Before we talk about what the specific mind games are, what are the goals of the mind games?
The goals of the mind games are for those who already have tremendous wealth and power to hold on to it and increase it. So whether it be financial or whether it be political, what they want is clear. They have achieved positions of tremendous influence. They're extraordinarily well off financially. They want to hold on to that, and they would love for it to become even more true. So that's what they're pushing to do. And these mind games are ways to try and make sure that the people, the American people more broadly, don't figure out what's going on and don't realize that by coming together and working collaboratively and avoiding divide and conquer efforts, we can accomplish a lot. You know, we can, if we recognize what's being done, we're better equipped to overcome it.
So in thinking about bottom up, I think that a lot of people live in a world where there's bottom up stuff going on all over, but they're like fish in water and they don't realize they're in water. And it seems like what you're describing is that the same kind of media environment is something that they don't even realize they're being affected by.
That's right. That's, you know, which is not to say that people aren't smart. We're very smart. I mean, but it is so pervasive, and particular individuals and groups have so much control over what we have access to in terms of the media or how the media presents an issue. They, to a large extent, they have tremendous influence over our political leaders. And so we are, bottom up is exactly the situation, and it's an uphill struggle because we've gotten to the point where the 1% have so much power and are masters at preserving it.
Well, from what I'm hearing, what you're saying is we need a lot more bottom up. We need a lot more of people working together and cooperating with each other and being in touch with each other to stand up to the problem that we're facing.
Absolutely. That's the challenge.
So now you just said that, you know, they want to hold on to what they have. They want to keep their wealth and their power. And so, and they're using these mind games to get people to stay, keep things the way they are. Are they directly doing it? I mean, I don't think that they're really just doing it directly. What are the goals besides holding on to their power? What are the effects on people? You're a psychologist. What are the effects that these people in power are trying to produce psychologically with people so that we leave things as they are?
Well, what they want to do is, it varies depending on the situation, but the kinds of things they want to accomplish is they want to scare us some of the time in order to benefit themselves. They want to create distrust within our own ranks so that working together becomes much more difficult and much less likely. They want us to feel helpless some of the time so that we give up on any idea that the world can be a better place than it is. And as a result of their success, we live in a country of extraordinary inequality. And, you know, the research shows that extreme inequality is unhealthy. It has damaging effects, both in terms of what communities are like, what our physical health is like, what our mental health is like. We would be better off with a more equal society. And in order to get there, the plutocrats have to lose some of what they have. And they don't want to.
What do you think they need to lose?
Well, they need to lose the control they have over our political system, or the degree to which they control it. There's research that shows that if you look at what the American people at large want politically, and what the 1%, you know, those in that situation want, and then you look at what Congress passes in terms of legislation, there tends to be clear correlation between what the 1% want and what Congress does, and essentially no correlation between what most Americans want and the actions of Congress. And it's a bad situation, obviously. It's not entirely surprising.
No, it's not surprising because a good chunk of Congress are members of the 1%.
Right. They're either members of the 1% or they're dependent on the wealth of the 1% in order to run their campaigns and be elected and be reelected. So that's not a surprise. And what, you know, so the kinds of things we need are elected officials who don't buy into that game, who aren't willing to be beholden to those with tremendous wealth in this country. I mean, that's just one example, kind of different.
I'm pursing my lips because I'm in a district where there's a primary where there's a millionaire running against two more regular people, and the millionaire was the one that the Democrats endorsed. And they deny it's because he had the money, but I think that's why it was. And I'm tired of seeing millionaires go to Congress because they can buy an election by having the money to buy the media.
Right. It's a huge problem that kind of regular people, I'll call them, such as you and me, would have a very hard time running for office simply for financial reasons. Aside, you know, the all the other aspects of winning office. But yes, money controls far too much of our political system, and it starts right with who is able to afford to run.
Okay. So you've got a different vision besides the plutocrats. What's your vision of where the U.S. should go? I mean, if your book did its job, what would change?
Well, hopefully my book could help a little bit in moving us toward a progressive vision that many people in the United States agree upon. So that's, you know, that's eliminating institutional racism. It's addressing the problems with for-profit prisons. It's dealing with the fact that so many live and rely on poverty wages to survive. It's addressing the nightmare of climate change in an effective way rather than pretending it doesn't exist. It's, you know, making education more affordable and more equal, you know, K through 12 more equal and, you know, at the university level more affordable. It's, you know, addressing, finding ways so that people are not, so many people are not so burdened by debt that keeps them from, you know, achieving what they hope to. The list goes on. It would be, you know, avoiding wars of aggression that benefit defense contractors above all else. So, I mean, I would summarize it as a progressive vision that many people, the majority of Americans, when you poll them, are in favor of, you know, issues of the sort and solutions of the sort I just described. They are anathema to today's plutocrats who have the upper hand.
And they're using these five different political mind games that you describe in your book to get people to just leave them alone and leave things the way they are. So I'm going to do a brief station ID and then we'll get back and you'll tell us what the five are in detail.
Great.
You're listening to the Rob Call Bottom Up Show, sponsored by opednews.com on Pacifica, Progressive Radio Network, iTunes, opednews.com/podcast with an S, and Stitcher.
My guest for this show is Roy Idelson, who is a clinical psychologist, and he's the author of a new book, Mind Games, and he describes five different ways that the plutocrats, or the 1%, are playing mind games with us. So go into the details again.
Okay, well, I've been doing this research for about 20 years now, and it started where I was trying to figure out what are the beliefs that people hold that tend to propel groups to conflict. And what I discovered is that there are five that are especially important, and over the years, I've taken those five and applied them in different ways and came to the realization that these are actually central to how we're manipulated by those who have tremendous wealth and power. So the five are vulnerability, injustice, distrust, superiority, and helplessness. And just to give an example, going back to my earliest work, it's easy to imagine, and you have probably heard in one situation or in another, a leader kind of make this simple argument. We are in great danger, that's vulnerability. We are being treated unfairly by those around us, that's injustice. We cannot trust our enemies, that's distrust. We are a great people who deserve better, that's superiority, and we cannot let ourselves be helpless against what's happening to us. That's helplessness. That's the kind of message that leads to war. I mean, that's not unusual. That we see that in various places, not just in the United States. Those same five issues, though, are used in more subtle ways. And the way I think of it now is, in a sense, there are five questions we ask ourselves regularly when we're trying to make sense of the world around us. So first, related to vulnerability, is, are we safe? It makes a tremendous difference to us whether we feel safe in the world or in peril. And we're constantly, on one level or another, looking around to assess whether, you know, we're in jeopardy, whether danger is on the horizon. Unfortunately, even though we're very sensitive to that, excuse me, we're not very good at making those determinations. So people can mislead us about whether we're safe or whether we're not. So that's vulnerability. Injustice, the question we ask is, are we being treated fairly? Are the people we care about being treated fairly? And we know from, you know, all kinds of sources, our own experiences and history, that issues of injustice are tremendous drivers of potential social change, you know, for good or for ill. So that's the second one. The third is distrust. We tend to divide the world into people and groups we believe are trustworthy and other that we think are not. And where we draw that line is really important. If we get it right, that's good. And, you know, we're going to be safer. We're going to be happier. We're going to have more positive relationships. We're not going to be betrayed. If we get it wrong, and for example, distrust those who actually deserve our trust, perhaps because of differences in race or ethnicity or religion, then we're losing out, and we're going to miss opportunities for growth or collaboration. But distrust, you know, we can't afford, in a sense, we can't afford to be wrong. We can't afford to put complete faith in someone and have him or her betray us. And that's, as a result, we can be suspicious even when we shouldn't be. And it's the 1% have come up with ways to take advantage of that. The fourth concern is superiority. We all want to feel that we're good enough. And the question we ask is, in a sense, is, are we good enough? People by nature tend to compare themselves to others. They'd like to, as a result of those comparisons, discover that they're good, that they're even better, you know, whether it be in their accomplishments or their values or the destiny that they imagine for themselves. But here, too, we're really susceptible to manipulation. We can be flattered. We can be told that others who are different are not worthy, that we are good, they are not. And again, it's an area where we're taken advantage of by those who are pursuing self-interest. And the fifth area is helplessness. And the question we ask, in a sense, every day is, can we control what's happening to us? It's really important to people to feel that they are able to influence the events in their lives. It's bad news. It's tremendously discouraging and demoralizing if you come to the conclusion that you're helpless. And part of the problem is, once you believe you're helpless, if you get to that point, it's very hard to turn that around. It's very hard to change that view. And people who feel they're helpless try less hard. They give up more easily, more quickly. And so again, the 1% are ready to take advantage of that kind of psychological concern.
There's been some interesting research on learned helplessness. They would put a rat in a box and they would electrify a certain part of the cage so that the rat would learn not to go there. And then they'd take away the electricity, and the rat would just stay in the part where it knew it was safe and never go back out to the other part that had been electrified that no longer was.
Right. And I mean, that's a perfect example. And that rat, or if that were a person, he or she would be potentially missing all kinds of opportunities on the other side.
Right.
But instead, they've given up.
And so many people have given up. I can't tell you how many times I talk to people and I say, you're going to vote in this primary? And they go, no, I'm not going to vote. It doesn't do anything. It's BS. It's a rotten system. And that's the people at the top succeeding. You know, and then I get it from progressives too, or people who profess to be on liberal or progressive or whatever, and they say, don't vote. Shun the system by not voting. And I just think that is just pure stupidity. I think you got to vote, and you got to face the fact that there are big problems with the electoral system, starting with money and electronic voting. There are a lot of problems, and access to voting and voting rights, but you got to vote. I mean, and that it's like those rats that were shocked and they just stay away. It's crazy. So I want to ask you, how did you come up with these five? Why these five?
These five, this was based on some of the early research I did with colleagues. And what first drove my interest was I was looking for what are the beliefs or the concerns that explain how groups behave and also explain how individuals behave. Because my thinking was, if we can understand what those issues are, the ones that apply equally well to you or me in our daily lives and also to other larger groups, whether it be political parties or communities or nations, those are probably especially important because they span that spectrum from the individual to the collective. And through the research I did, these were the five. These are the five that, in my judgment and from my experience, can be used, for example, clinically. I don't practice clinically anymore, but for many years I did. And it's not uncommon for clients, for their challenges or their struggles to revolve around one or more of these five issues. And it's certainly true that a lot of the conflict in the world revolves between groups and nations, revolves around these same issues of vulnerability, injustice, distrust, superiority, and helplessness. People have different perceptions. You know, nations, for example, disagree about where the injustice lies. People disagree about where the injustice may lie in a given situation. But there's no question that injustice drives behavior.
Okay. So give some examples of how some of these mind games work.
Okay, well, in the book, for each of the five areas, I describe four mind games. So there are a total of 20 in the book. And if I, you know, a common one in regard to vulnerability is the idea that change is dangerous. Okay, that if we want to be safe, we need to leave things the way they are. And this is often a message of the 1%. And it's an argument that is used to keep us away from universal healthcare, you know, from significant changes in the way healthcare is provided in the country. It's an argument, change is dangerous, is used to defend maintaining a military budget that is, you know, larger or as large as the next 9 countries combined. And is clearly wasteful in a variety of ways. A lot of the debate about taxes or raising taxes, one of the go-to arguments from corporate CEOs and other such types is that if we change the system dramatically, it will imperil the country. That raising taxes will on the wealthy will lead to the loss of jobs. The economy will collapse. So change is dangerous is one of the 20 mind games. It's one of the four vulnerability mind games. I describe examples in the book.
So what do we do about it? So how do we deal with those mind games?
The way we have to deal with it is it's similar to inoculation, the way we deal with avoiding the flu. Although
now inoculation is also a psychological term in behavioral therapy, I know.
Right. Well, when I refer to inoculation, the inoculation model in psychology comes from the medical model or the public health model. The idea being, going back to the flu, and it doesn't always work, obviously, for those who got the shot and got the flu thereafter. If we get a small dose of the virus that we want to avoid, we develop antibodies, and those antibodies are then ready and on alert should we then be hit with a full-blown attack of that virus. So we're better able to withstand it. So with the same logic, inoculation theory in psychology or in the area of persuasion is that if people are exposed to the arguments that they're going to hear, and it's explained to them in a sense in advance why those arguments are flawed, why they are being manipulated, and there's what those who are offering those arguments, what is their motivation? What is the self-interest at stake for them? If we know that in advance and we're offered counter arguments, kind of that show us that the explanations that we're going to hear are not the correct ones, that there are better ones, and here they are, then we're inoculated. In a sense, then we are not only better able to withstand the claims, the false claims the 1% make every day, we are better able to engage and help other people resist them.
Now, it's really not just the 1%. I mean, the mainstream media help the 1%. They're the magnifying tool for the 1% that get their message out there, because they, in their totally fraudulent claims of being unbiased, report these statements, these positions, without criticizing them, without giving the kind of information and rational analysis of them that would help people to inoculate themselves to the claims that are being made, right?
Absolutely. And the mainstream media, they are big corporations, yep, with executives who are among the wealthiest people in the country. That there are tremendous journalists.
It's not just the executives, I believe I recently read that Sean Hannity is worth at least $40 million, maybe several hundred million dollars. And there are a good number of these anchors who are worth at least eight figures, which is $10 million or more. And lots of them are worth $5 million, $6-8 million. I think I saw that Joy Reid was worth $8 million at MSNBC. She's one of the 1%. Most of them are. I'm sure Rachel Maddow is worth $50-100 million.
They're right. The network personalities, whether it's Fox or MSNBC or whatever it might be, they are exceedingly well paid. No question about it. I want to emphasize that there are at the same time I basically agree with you, Rob. There are, you know, tremendous journalists doing incredibly important work who may work for some of the mainstream media outlets. So it's a balancing act of sorts. The problem.
I'm sorry, I just don't think that the really great journalists are the ones getting the great money. I don't think that Glenn Greenwald or Jeremy Scahill or Bartlett and Steele, I don't think they're the ones who are seeing seven-figure, eight-figure incomes, unfortunately. I think I brought up the liberal and progressive name people because, you know, you got to think twice about the information you're getting from everybody, because those are one percenters too. And I think even those who are seen to be progressive, they leave out some of the details and they don't cover all the inoculative facts and perspectives that you're talking about.
Right. I agree with you. I would make two observations. One is, from my perspective, not everyone with tremendous wealth fits into my, in a sense, definition of the 1%. I'm referring to people who have that tremendous wealth or power and use it for certain purposes. I'm not singling out one person or another in terms of who fits that profile or not, but certainly the mainstream media limits, and I mean, it's tremendously influential, and it make choices are made, you know, whether the whole idea of fair and balanced, which, you know, is no longer Fox's motto, but the idea that we must always supposedly present two sides, when in fact one side is lies and the other side is truth.
Amen.
Or the way it's framed. This has changed a little, but for years, and to some extent it's still true, the mainstream media will not use the word torture to describe what we have done to detainees in CIA black sites or in Guantanamo Bay, that they'll say harsh interrogation or kind of extreme this or that. And for a long time, they would not use torture, even though if the very same acts were committed against Americans, they would rush to say these fellow citizens were tortured. Well, that's a decision that comes from on high in regard to how the mainstream media, its relationship with the White House, for example, you know, kind of, or with Congress, or with those in positions of power, what do they or don't they want to hear? We know that the whole issue of warrantless wiretapping, you know, that there was a delay in that information being released back in, I guess it was 2004, until after the election. That there was the research had been done, the case was strong, but the leading papers, or at least one of them,
made deals with the administrations. So we need to do another station ID now. This is the Rob Call Bottom Up Show, sponsored by opednews.com. That's progressive news and opinion that you're not going to get on mainstream media, not any of the mainstream network news agents. We've got great articles, about 500 a month, and we are doing the work that really needs to be done to help to inoculate people, to help to show what's going on. And we've published some of the work of this guest here, Roy Idelson, a psychologist and the author of Political Mind Games, How the 1% Manipulate Our Understanding of What's Happening, What's Right, and What's Possible. And Roy has been telling us about five different kinds of ways that the plutocrats play mind games with us: safety, injustice, distrust, superiority, and hopelessness. And why don't you tell us a little bit more about examples of the ones you haven't discussed so far, and then what we do to inoculate.
Okay, so...
And we got about 20 minutes left.
Okay, great. So I gave an example of a vulnerability mind game, changes is dangerous, and how the 1% use that. And one example of an injustice mind game would be, we're fighting injustice. That this is the argument that is used repeatedly when those with tremendous wealth and power, what they actually want to do is secure their advantages, but they'll frame it in terms of, and there's an example of framing, they'll frame it in terms of making sure that the world is just or more just. And this is the argument, you know, recently a clear case is the efforts at voter suppression. So it's clear that leaders, especially of the GOP, would very much like certain groups not to vote, that they're likely not to vote for not just the likes of Trump, but, you know, more typical Republicans and conservatives either.
So what they're going to do is they're going to make it harder to register to vote. They're going to make it harder to vote by requiring voter ID. They're going to get rid of voting polling places in poor neighborhoods where there are people who tend to not vote Republican. You know, the ideal situation for voting should be that everybody is required to vote and they're penalized if they don't. And that when a person turns of age, and I've come to think that that age should be 16 after what we've seen recently. When a person comes of age, they automatically are registered to vote, and the voting should be done on ballots that can be properly recounted, not just pushing the button for an electronic recount, which is no recount at all. And yet, I think what you're getting at is the message they give is, oh, we're going to protect the vote by making it so that everybody has to have an ID, even though the number of people who vote illegally because of that issue is infinitesimally small.
Exactly. So
sorry I jumped in there, but it's...
No, that was the perfect examples of what I was trying to describe. But so how do you get away with that? How do you suppress the vote by making it harder to vote? You do it by saying we're fighting injustice. And if you can make it sound true, then people are more accepting of that. Then you'll hear, well, you know, so maybe what's wrong with requiring a birth certificate in order to register or whatever. And that's where we get into this problem that we're fighting injustice has the ring of truth.
And I think the other part of it is that it's not like they just use one of these alone. Like they might throw in superiority. They may make it like those people are the ones who are going to violate the law and cheat. And like Trump said, millions of illegal immigrants voted illegally, and that's why the count was so off and why he didn't win by 3 million.
Right, right. Yeah, they regularly, these mind games are used in combinations, which just makes them more pernicious and harder to combat. But if we're prepared, we can do it.
You're listening to the Rob Call Bottom Up Show, sponsored by opednews.com on Pacifica, Progressive Radio Network, iTunes, opednews.com/podcast with an S, and Stitcher.
If I take a distrust mind game example, I'll mention two. One is the mind game, the claim by the 1% that they are devious and dishonest.
They
being whoever it might be.
Non-white men.
Right. Yep. Or workers who are trying to organize, you know, for better pay. Related to it, but different, is the mind game, they're misguided and misinformed. So this is where instead of trying to make their opponents out as kind of evil. The 1% kind of take a patronizing approach and say, well, you know, they don't really understand and they're misguided and misinformed. And either one can be used depending on who they're trying to target. I think we saw both recently with the Never Again movement, you know, kind of looking for gun reform. The amazing kids from Florida and the amazing kids from other cities where that haven't gotten the same attention in trying to address gun violence. There was an effort by the NRA first to make them out as actors. There were claims, well, these aren't really high school kids. That's their devious and dishonest mind game. And when that didn't seem to stick, the really the go-to one in terms of distrust has been they're misguided and misinformed. You know, they're just 16 and 17-year-olds. They don't really understand. They're being manipulated by, you know, bigger liberal forces who are trying to take advantage of the situation. But so two examples of distrust mind games there. To get in one superiority and one helplessness example, in terms of superiority, we often, the 1% or their allies often use what I call the they are losers mind game. And this is the way to justify extreme inequality, poverty wages, unemployment, hopelessness. If instead of our understanding that in fact there are systemic, structural, institutional problems that create these situations, if we simply instead focus on the individual, you know, that he or she is a loser, they're not good enough, they never tried hard enough.
And this gets into the superiority category that you're talking about.
Right, yeah, this is one of the superiority mind games.
I've done a lot of interviews and thought a lot about narcissism and psychopaths, and every psychopath is a narcissist, of course. Where does that fit into this?
The clearest way it fits in is a different superiority mind game, which I call we've earned it. And this is where the 1% promulgate the view, and in some cases they may believe it themselves, that they deserve everything they have, that nothing came to them easy. Doesn't matter that they inherited fortunes.
On third base.
Right. Yep. But not in their eyes. In their eyes, they've worked hard, or they're smarter, or they're better in one way or another, and they deserve the tremendous wealth or tremendous power they hold. That's narcissism. Tom Perkins, I think, who died a couple years ago, but he was one of the one percenters who got into a debate that involved comparing the Occupy movement and such efforts to kind of Nazis going after Jews. That the 1%, you know, were being treated in the same way the Jews were being treated in Germany during World War II. But one of the things which is awful, and that's the key thing, but at the same time, while he was alive, he had the largest boat in the world, the largest yacht in the world, and he was asked why, and he said, I just wanted to be the person with the largest yacht. I mean, that's narcissism. There's no other way to describe it. So,
and to make it reminds me of Tom Hartman has a website registered. I think it goes something like smallpenisgunowners.com. Somehow that seems to apply to the guy who needs to have the biggest boat.
It might.
Yeah. That's, you know, I just think that kind of display of opulence is disgusting. It's it's mentally ill, really. And it's a kind of, what's the word? Hoarding.
Yep. Well, that, right. Extreme inequality, I guess, is a version of hoarding.
Yeah. So I want to try to get through the other ones. We've kind of touched a little bit on superiority. Did you cover it as much as you wanted to? And we also have to cover helplessness.
So let's go to helplessness, which is the fifth of the five concerns. And here, one example of a helplessness mind game is change is impossible. And whenever those in charge, whenever the 1%, want to keep things the way they are, they're likely to say, if only, it's not that we think it's a terrible idea that you want kind of greater equality or this or that. It's just not possible. Globalization is a good example. Yes, they will say they're going to be losers with globalization. There are going to be people who are impoverished as a result of this. There are going to be jobs lost. There's nothing we can do about it. That's the nature of the world. Or sometimes they'll say it's human nature. We have such inequality because it's human nature to strive, and those who are better are going to kind of pull away from those who aren't.
You sure have created a sense of helplessness when it comes to the NRA and gun control.
Right. And that's changing. That's a great example of, something has, we'll see where it goes, but something has changed in, the past couple months, suggesting that maybe we are going to see a different world in regard to guns and gun violence. What the NRA has also done historically is used a second helplessness mind game, which is we'll all be helpless. And this is the argument that if we let this happen, if we allow these reforms to take place, it will take us down a road that will lead to a terrible place, and we will not be able to do anything about it. This is the claim that we'll lose all our guns.
Yeah, I was out trying to get petitions for a candidate, and I had to ask them what their party was, and I asked one woman, and she said, she was wearing a uniform. Maybe she was a police officer or a crossing guard. And she said, I want to keep my guns because when we're invaded, I want to be able to protect myself from the invaders. That's delusional.
Yes. Yep. But she's getting that message from somewhere. She's not, odds are she is not alone in believing that. And the people she spends most of her time with believe it as well. And again, it's not hard to persuade people that the world is more dangerous than it actually is. And, that's, again, as I mentioned earlier, that's another, it's a dangerous world. I may not have mentioned it, is a vulnerability mind game that is used to great effect. I mean, that got us into the rock.
So you also explore how Trump used this. Where does Donald Trump fit into this mind game story?
Well, I see he used these mind games painfully effectively during his presidential campaign. So the whole build a wall, build a wall, build a wall was about vulnerability. He played on injustice, claiming, the people weren't getting what they deserve, and then gave himself as an example of someone, who was being treated unjustly. He certainly tried to stir up distrust of various people or various...
And the fake media.
Right, and the fake media. He played on kind of blind patriotism, the idea that America is great no matter what its policies may be, and that he was going to make it great again. So he used these really well, but and now we're in this situation. But I don't think he's certainly not the first among the 1% to use these mind games to achieve selfish aims. That's been going on since long before Trump became a politician. So in a sense, I think of him, at least in part, as a symptom of a society and a system that has failed so many Americans, and that has enabled these mind games, these individuals and these groups, to gain the wealth and power that enables them to then use these mind games to maintain it and increase it.
So you mentioned, you kind of alluded to American exceptionalism. And one of the regular contributors to Op-Ed News, David Swanson, has a book coming out challenging American exceptionalism. Where does American exceptionalism fit into your model? And you got about a minute left.
Okay. Well, it fits in under core concern or core issue is superiority. And that's where you'll see references to American exceptionalism. There's a mind game. We're pursuing a higher purpose. So the United States can do something, the same problematic or bad thing that another country does or another group does. When we do it, it's because of some higher purpose that will be achieved. That's American exceptionalism. And it works because we identify as Americans, and that group identification, which is psychological, can be used to advance policies.
Okay, we've got a wrap. My guest for this show has been Roy Idelson. He's a clinical psychologist. He's the former executive director of the Solomon Asch Center for a Study of Ethnopolitical Conflict at the University of Pennsylvania, the past president of Psychologists for Social Responsibility, and he is the author of a new book, Political Mind Games. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks very much, Rob. Appreciate the opportunity.
You've been listening to the Rob Call Bottom Up Show, sponsored by opednews.com on Pacifica, Progressive Radio Network, iTunes, opednews.com/podcasts with an S, and Stitcher. Humanity is transitioning back from a predominantly top-down culture to a more bottom-up one. It's changing everything. I'm Rob Call, and I have conversations about top-down, bottom-up, about change and making change happen, with some of the smartest, most interesting people in the world. Thanks for listening, and remember, the world's a better place with bottom-up connection consciousness.